and welcome to the Picture House podcast, the first podcast of 2019. Thank you for joining us after the festivities, the New Year's. We're here knee-deep in January, full of Oscar corridor films. There's so many movies in cinema right now, too many for me to tackle on my own. So I'm very delighted to be joined by Karina Antrobus.
Hello.
And Sarah Cook.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us on the pod, guys.
As ever, a pleasure.
Yeah.
Well, we're like just coming up to halfway through January. There's so many films out in cinemas right now.
It's crazy. It's just the cornucopia of cinema.
I think it's the best time for it because January is really dull and cold and dark. Where's the best place to be? The cinema.
It's when all the good movies come out as well.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And it's all obviously strategic because of award season, but yeah, it's great.
So you work at Pitch House Central, and I imagine it's been reasonably busy over the last few days?
I think the word mental comes into mind. It has been crazy. We've had a lot of people going to The Favourite and wanting to see that, and then some of the films we're going to talk about, loads of people are flocking to. So yeah, it's been rightfully mental.
That's good. It's a good place to start. So you mentioned it, yeah, it has been very busy. Customers have been coming to watch all sorts in our cinemas. We'll go into the top five highest grossing films at Picture House over the last week. Karina, what do you think we expect to see in this chart?
Obviously The Favourite.
Obviously.
Yeah, obviously The Favourite, yeah. I mean, I'm just going on the screening that I went to at Hackney Picture House, which was packed last Friday, queues outside the door. It was buzzing. So, yeah, if that's not in the top five, then I'll eat my hat.
Okay, that's good. And Karina is wearing a hat, listeners. We can confirm that she has something to eat. Sarah, what do you expect to see in the top five?
I was literally going to say I would eat my hat if The Favourite wasn't number one. So, yeah. A lot of hat eating going on right now. I would think Free Solo will still be in there.
Yes.
Those people are still going to see. And I think it probably expands. I wouldn't be surprised if we've got that for like another month or so because of how popular Free Solo is.
Yes.
Yeah, really pleased to see such a great documentary and a documentary really pulling the crowds.
We don't often get talk about documentaries on this podcast, especially not in the top five. Like, we might review them, but they don't often make it to top five. So, well, let's see. So in at number five, Colette is in the list, which we're going to talk about later because it had previews.
Yes,
so Colette's got in on previews, but don't worry, we'll come back to Keira Knightley's new movie in the review section. Number four is Bohemian Rhapsody.
Wow.
The now Golden Globe winning and BAFTA nominated Bohemian Rhapsody.
I forgot that we put that back on. I should have known that. But yeah.
I don't think it ever went out. I think it's just been, I think in some way, in some small capacity, it's always been sort of ticking away in the background.
It's such a bizarre movie in that it's so, it's so fun, but it's not an awards movie. And
it's
here
crazy.
It is, at littering all the nomination lists. It's like, okay. I guess it's great because now people are going to back to see it to see what all the fuss is about.
Yes.
And what the fuss is the last 20 minutes. It all pays off, all that endurance of the first hour and a bit, and then you see the 20-minute Live Aid set, and you're like, okay, great, that I had fun.
Can we just nominate the Live Aid for, like, best short film, and I'll be yes, more contented
well, exactly.
with that? Like,
exactly.
Then,
sounds like you're not a fan, Terry.
I have this issue with it, it's the same issues I've had with films like American Hustle and other kind of movies that are quite averagely made and didn't really, like, grip me, and yet everyone's clambering over it. So the more that happens, the more I'm like, hate it a little bit more, especially when it outs films such as You Will Never Really Hear the Rider, Leave No Trace, and any female-fronted directed film, like masterpieces that came out and directed by women. And then all of a sudden we're like, oh, Bohemian Rhapsody. It's like, oh, well.
But they didn't have a Queen soundtrack.
I tell you, yeah. If only Joaquin Phoenix hammered people to Don't Stop Me Now, like Dawn of the Dead.
I think the Golden Globe nod is going to keep it in cinemas, and the BAFTA nominations. Hey, it might win some BAFTAs. And the Oscar nominations are out next week.
Yep.
It could be Oscar nominated.
It probably will be.
Number three is also a BAFTA nominated film. It's Free Solo.
Yay!
Hooray!
Brilliant. Excellent.
I saw somewhere that of the market share for this film, Picture House is making up like a third of the total box office.
That's fantastic. And it's tipped over a million now at the overall box office, which is incredible for a documentary.
Well, it's distributor Dogworth's first ever film over £1 million.
Yeah.
And they've been, which is amazing. Those
well
guys
deserved.
Do such hard work. And this film is really connected with audiences, which is so nice to see. It's so nice to see it working so well at Central in that giant screen one. I see it's continually sort of getting close to selling out, even though it's been out now for over a month.
It's comfortably clinging on, if I'm going to use a rhyming pun.
It is a big screen experience as well, considering so many documentaries are shunted to the smaller screen or people think that they can wait and watch that at home because of the cinematography of it and those wide landscape thrilling shots of him hanging off a cliff is that's you need to watch it in the big screen. They've IMAX
just,
if possible.
Yeah, they've just released expanded it to IMAX screens, and I can't think of anything more terrifying to watch an IMAX screen but utterly gripping. Like 3D it, like let's just go for it and give audiences it's I spent the whole time like it was a horror film, like underneath my scarf.
Well, this is it. Shout out to our sponsorship manager Lisa Cardell, who today I heard she had to leave halfway through to go and get a drink and break her dry January in order to get through the rest of the movie.
That's intense.
Free soloing.
Well, I was basically stress eating throughout the whole film. So it's definitely it definitely evokes some sort of physical response from audiences.
And there's a relationship drama there in there as well. So
that's true. It's a really incredible film. We were lucky enough to have the directors of the film on this podcast, recorded in this very studio, Silk in Soho, which is very nice. So do check the pod feed for the free solo special. We'd just seen an advert for the film on the side of a London bus, and they were very excited about that.
That's big. You made it then.
Number two, Mary Poppins Returns.
Oh, of course.
You guys forgot about Mary Poppins.
Because I haven't seen it yet.
What?
I'm saving it for Sunday.
It's a Sunday film.
Yeah, I think I will have a hangover on Sunday, and I think that might be the best way to give me some tonic.
Fair enough.
I haven't seen it either. And that's, what? Well, I promised friends that I'd go watch it, and as adult people, arranging times now is impossible, so we've had to like cancel and rearrange, and it's getting to the point now where I'm like, right, if you don't agree to this time, I will go watch it without you.
See it twice and act surprised.
Like, oh, Mary Poppins, the music, not that I'm singing along to it, like.
Listener Sarah is Captain Musicals. When The Greatest Showman came out, you I think introduced a number of screenings dressed up as The Greatest Showman.
Yeah.
When we did the sing-along versions, and you've seen that film countless times. I'm surprised you haven't seen the brand new musical.
I know, I'm being good. I made a promise to friends.
You're such pure of heart.
Pure of heart. And then I'll enjoy it. But I have like been listening to, because I've been like doing work, and I just like press my ear up against the screen just to listen to the music. just a taste of it.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you guys some pod homework, because it's likely Mary Poppins will stick around in top five. Please watch it before the next podcast.
That's where I've saved it. I wanted to save my time for things that I thought might not be at the cinema for as long. That's my strategy.
That's good.
I will get there.
That's good. You're gaming this. Mm-hmm. And in at number one, I think you're both right, The Favourite is up there. The film, it came out, I think, on New Year's Day, and it's got amazing reviews, obviously lots of awards, nominations. I think the most BAFTA nominations this year for one single title, and it won Golden Globes. Olivia Colman won a Golden Globe for her performance in the
Olivia.
Movie. This is maybe the Oscar frontrunner as well.
Yeah, I think so. 17 BAFTA nominations.
That's too many.
17?
get rid of some of them.
I can't think of one that they're not. Maybe the best actors, but they could have snuck one in for Nicholas Houlton.
That's true.
They could have done the best supporting.
I think best supporting duck. There's an excellent duck in the film called Horatio.
Horatio.
Has such a, it's just wonderful on screen. It's a really good punchline to a gag. So yeah, probably best supporting duck. But this is the new Yorgos Lanthimos film, who brought us films like The Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer. And he's really popular with our audiences. But this film in particular has really connected, I think, and maybe got a new audience in to see his films.
I would agree. I mean, the all-female cast, and it's obviously playing into this theme that we have at the moment of very period female-led dramas with a queer bent, which is just, it's so great to see all of this in the cinema and selling out out seats. You know,
easiest sell in the world. If you came up to me at any point in my life and was like, Olivia Colman, Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz are playing lesbians in a period drama, I would have been like, yes, it's directed by the guy who did The Lobster. I'm like,
powerhouse.
Yeah.
And Robbie Ryan is the cinematographer, and I was loving how lush and opulent all the visionary of it was. And then I saw Robbie Ryan's name at the end. I was like, oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. He's a genius.
It is just beautiful. The music's great. The comedy's great. But like the emotional part of it is great. Like Olivia Colman has this one bit where she goes from really ecstatic to really sad in like the space of 2 minutes. And to watch those, her mastery, because there's no one like Olivia Colman who can do that. And then do like that scene, the most famous scene where she's shouting at the boy, and then just be so heartbreaking like in the next scene. She doesn't win the Oscar, I'd be sorely surprised if she doesn't scoop that up.
Let's see. I think the question is, how big is Olivia Colman in the US? Like, I think Broadchurch is probably actually the biggest thing. It was so popular in the US. I feel like she's got BAFTA sewn up, maybe.
Yeah.
Everyone loves Olivia Colman. Most of the people in BAFTA probably worked with Olivia Colman in the US, maybe, compared to Glenn Close or whoever else might be nominated. She might not be as big a deal, but her people seem to love the film, and maybe it'll... You'd ideally like someone to be rewarded on the merit of that single film, but it rarely is.
I think it's between those two. After the Golden Globes, I think Glenn Close, Olivia Colman, I'd be surprised if anyone else gets a look in this award season. It's going to be like those are going to be the race.
I'd quite like to see Glenn Close and Olivia Colman just arm wrestle for it.
Yeah.
Let's decide by arm wrestle.
Can we just give it to them both? I always agree that actresses this year have just been so stellar that we should just have no male categories. Just award loads of women and everyone just go away happy.
Mm. You're right, the conversation is around actress because who is going to be nominated for Best Actor? I don't know.
Who cares?
There's a lot of, like, I guess we should probably put someone in. I think there's people who are obviously very good and stuff, but they're not what people are talking about. They're not the memorable performances.
I know. I think for me, the most memorable will be Bradley Cooper in A Star is Born. That's the only one I can think of that was really, really punchy and really, like...
I mean, it's very good, but I think for me it will be memorable because it was unexpected.
Yeah.
So I always knew he was a good actor, but I didn't know he was able to act and direct and sing and do all these things and build this chemistry with a pop star. I think his performance of a alcoholic was very, very good. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. We're not sitting here going, look at all the male actors this year. It's incredible. It is very much a female topic of conversation this year, and that's great.
Should we talk about some new films? Brand new films. Let's start with Colette, because it's sort of had one of those weird, like, midweek openings. So it's been out for a bit longer. It's made it into the top five. And this is a new film from Keira Knightley, starring Keira Knightley. And you've both seen it quite recently.
Yeah, I managed to watch it on Wednesday on the preview day, which is always a nice treat. It's directed by somebody with the best name ever, I think, Wash Westmoreland. Mm. He's a British director. Yeah, he's directed a very wonderful film about the legacy of Colette, the writer who had many of her brilliant stories overwritten by her husband, who took all her stories and sold them and made loads of money and refused to put her name to it. Dominic West stars alongside Colette. I think they are wonderful together. They have some brilliant chemistry and some great performances. I love Dominic West himself. It's a very by-the-book, handsome, linear story. It's very appeasing. It's very much a crowd-pleasing film. But yeah, I loved it. I thought the depiction of how Dominic West was just expanding in his gross masculinity, he has an expanding waistline, he farts, he sleeps with other women, and he blames it on the fact that his gender is just so rubbish at being fateful, which is just pathetic. And alongside that, you have Colette, who is finding her voice through her creativity and finding her sexuality with other women and her own agency. And she has such fire. And I wasn't really sold on Keira Knightley until I saw this film. I thought she was fantastic in it, and I was really drawn in by everything that she was portraying in this character.
It's a really beautiful film in terms of its production. It's one of those films where I didn't realise this quite to the end, but it's set over such a large period of time. Like,
yeah.
Keira Knightley starts off playing a teenager, and she ends up, she's like in the late 30s, I think. Like, and Keira Knightley's such a good actor to do that, because you can totally like dress her and do the makeup to make her look so young, and then she can sort of grow into this role. And the great thing about the character is it's her sort of coming out in more ways than one, but sort of, you know, becoming her own person. And I just think she's so perfectly cast.
Yeah, I think so.
She's someone who does attract criticism. I've always sort of liked Keira Knightley, and I'm like, I don't see what the problem is, guys. It's Keira Knightley, she's great.
Again, I don't think she's actually had a role where she can really be fiery in her feminism. It's always been, and she's spoken about this herself, she hasn't had a role that isn't, I mean, she's always a girlfriend or a sidekick, whereas this, she is the...
A pirate.
She is the front runner, and she's poised, and she's angry, and she's creative, and she's fierce. But she's also representative of so many different women throughout history who have had to have some acceptance to the fact that men are first in this society. And it's not that she just bows down and accepts it, but there is a certain residing that women have to do to just get through. I love the, I wouldn't spoil it too much, but at the very end, there's quotes that have been written by her herself, and they're great Instagrammable quotes. You know, there's a lot of truth in what she says. Very intelligent.
Keira Knightley really, for me, blossomed at Begin Again. Begin Again and Laggies. And then I think ever since that, she just took off.
Laggies.
I mean, right?
That's the epitome of what we, I think that's where I left Keira Knightley. I was like, no, I can't.
But I think the more she does, like, she kind of goes, the more she goes off like a popular line, the better she is. And I think Colette is, I think that for people going in, don't expect like a quiet period drama tone, because it's set in like Bohemian France, where everything was outrageous and they were open. What surprised me is how open she was, and how open she was with him, who, Dominic West is having particular fun being this odious creep of a man, and together they make this really good like spark on screen. But I went in and just did not expect how tonally different it was to what I had in my head. But yeah, Keira Knight, she is. I think she has just been quietly amassing brilliance, and she just shines here. They just let her shine.
I think it's like very much her movie. Like, obviously her name is in the title of the film, but I think that maybe gives her the freedom and the power to, you know, shape the role a bit.
Yeah,
I think it only works because Dominic West is so good and they're so good together. Like, what great casting.
Absolutely.
You wouldn't have them down as like this couple if you were like casting from their headshots. But put two great actors together and they have so much fun, and you can totally see at the beginning like why she's attracted to him, why he's attracted to her, and then how they begin to like push against each other, and they sort of hate each other towards the end, but they're tapped in this like professional sort of agreement they've got, where he's publishing her books under his name because he's the established name, the like French writer Willy, and he's putting these books out.
There is a love and a fascination that they have with one another, and there's so many times that he plays away, but he comes back, and when he says, "I can't love anyone else but you," you believe it, and you can see that she does too. And even though she wanders off and has extramarital affairs on her own accord, she comes back as well, and she forgives him. And because that's the complexities of relationships, you do end up forgiving those that you love, as problematic as that is.
So this film is out at the same time as things like The Favourite and things. Why hasn't Keira Knightley got a BAFTA nomination?
I think if it was any other year and we didn't have like Glenn Close and we didn't have, you know, Olivia Colman,
I think up against The Favourite it was going to be a tricky one. And if you think about exactly what Colette is in The Shadows of The Wife, which is essentially the same story pretty much, and The Shadows of the period drama opulence of The Favourite, unfortunately Colette does fall short.
Yeah.
Doesn't have the romp and the sexiness. It does. It's very sexy. It's very merry and fun. But yeah, the kind of punk of The Favourite is missing from it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is just missing that one thing.
A certain depth.
Yeah.
Interesting. I sort of saw it blind. I hadn't seen any posters or anything when I saw the movie at London Film Festival. And I think the way they've gone from the marketing, it does look sort of like quite a safe garden variety period drama. And it isn't that. It's more than that. But I guess they're trying to appeal to a certain audience. But I guess my message is, like, if you see the poster and you're like, oh, I'm not sure, give it a go, because it isn't really the film the poster is telling you it is. It's more than that. It's a bit more complex. It's made by, I mean, a great filmmaker. The director made Still Alice, but also the producers are the producers of Carol and Number 9 Films, who make so many brilliant British movies.
Yeah.
So like, it's from Stephen Woolley and Elizabeth Garson. Like, these guys make really great, daring movies. You know, it's from quite bold filmmakers.
Wash is very good at creating very dynamic female characters as well, what with Still Alice. And Echo Park is another indie little hit. And he's actually, I've found out today that he's releasing a film this year called Earthquake Bird, starring Alicia Vikander as the main, but it's on Netflix. So, yeah. Watch this space, maybe, whatevs.
Earthquake Bird sounds like Cockney rhyming slang or something.
Yeah. But no, Colette, you go and see with your mum.
Maybe not your nan, though.
The Wife, you go and see with your nan. Colette, you go and see with your mum. And The Favourite, you go and see with your best mate.
Wow.
That is a great summary. I love that. I really love that, yeah. And it's so true.
Could be a meme. Let's get on it, guys. So sticking with period dramas of historical figures, shall we talk about the other new film out this week, Stan and Ollie? I'm looking at Sarah now because Sarah, I think over the time I've known her, has made it very clear that she is a big fan of the director of this film. And it would be wrong for me to proceed without passing it over to you.
Yeah, just a small fan. Stan and Ollie is directed by John S. Baird, who directed phenomenal indie dark comedy Filth. Make sure you guys go and watch that. And Stan Ollie is a wonderful, lovely biographical film about Laurel and Hardy. And it revolves around their later years as their star is fading and friction in their camp has caused them to split and then come back together. And they're doing this kind of farewell tour over England that's not doing so well. And it's all about how they, you know, in their old age, how they try and bring the spark and the comedy back to the failing audience. And it stars Steve Coogan as Stan Laurel and John C. Reilly as Oliver Hardy. And they are the perfect pairing. You go into this film and you are so touched and moved by these performances. Steve Coogan puts in one of his best performances. He acts off the screen. He has these little bits and little moments where you're just, he doesn't have to move or do anything extravagant. You just get the emotion of what Stan Laurel is going through watching his friend age and fall apart.
He's been nominated, hasn't he, for a BAFTA?
Yeah, it's really funny because in America, John C. Reilly is getting all the nods and over here, Steve Coogan's getting all of them, which doesn't surprise me at all. But it's happily got three BAFTA nominations for Best Outstanding Film, Best Actor. And it's just great. It's got this wonderful other double act in it with Shirley Henderson and Inari Ander playing their wives, Lucille and Ida, and their great rapport. And then there's like the double acts between the wives and the husbands. And what Baird brings into this and injects into it alongside Jess Pope's script is these comedy moments in their everyday life. So in between, it's shown in between their theatre shows and performances and like press performances. And then you see their little comedy that comes in, and it's like honors all their classic sketches, like bringing the music box, they bring the piano up the stairs, and then the hats, and you can just see what comical geniuses they are, just the little movements they do. And it's just a brilliant, lovely film. When you talk about films to take your mum and your nan to, it's just impeccable. A nice, lovely Sunday afternoon flick with your family.
I think it's handled really well. Like it's a lesser known tour. You don't expect Hollywood icons to tour musicals of the north of England in their later careers. But it shows you them at the peak of their career as well. When they're in Hollywood on a backlot making a movie, I think they're doing Way Out West, and it's the famous scene. If you know Laurel and Hardy, there's this famous dance scene in that film. And it's this really amazing like tracking shot, like a single take from DP Laurie Rose, who shot this movie, who works with Ben Wheatley quite a lot. And they're really good at doing the young Stan and Ollie when they're in their heyday. But they're so good at this sort of like slightly faded, I've seen better time, and they got the wrinkles around their eyes, and you can see sort of the years on them. But whenever they're in front of the audience, and this is why their performances are so good, whenever the characters are in front of even like one person, they turn on the charm. And when they're behind closed doors, they completely turn into other characters. So it's sort of like there's so many like layers to their performances, and it's great that Coogan's been nominated. It's a shame John C. Reilly wasn't for BAFTA either.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of reactions, people who prefer John C. Reilly's performance, people who prefer Coogan's. Like I'm in the Coogan camp. I think there's a moment where Coogan's watching, like Laurel's watching Hardy on stage and feeling all these emotions, and I was welling up because it's just so beautifully handled. And what surprised me, it's so surprising, it's introducing like Stan and Ollie to a brand new generation, but what surprised me is I didn't know that Stan Laurel was British.
Oh, wow.
So when I was watching it and he had this...
Did you not?
I didn't know this.
The bowler hats.
The bowler hats.
But is that a British thing? I thought it was.
For me, like, my first contact with Laurel Hardy was a picture in Joey and Chandler's frame, like, in Friends.
How interesting. Yeah,
so for me... Then
that
like,
was your reference.
That was my
an
reference.
American TV show.
American TV show. So you kind of think they're an American comedy act, and then actually all the genius comes from Stan Laurel, and he's from Lancashire. And when I spent the first 5 minutes of the film going, this is a weird accent for Steve Coogan to do. And then it turns out it's the correct one.
Yeah.
It sort of touches on key moments in their career. Like they were just put together by a studio. The producer owns all the rights to their movies. So they're not super wealthy. They're doing fine. But when they're not working with that producer, they are sort of on their own. And that's why they've taken this job touring these musicals in England. Karina, do you think this is something... You haven't seen the film, have you?
I have not seen the film, and I will go and see the film. It is something that kind of tapped into the tapestry of my childhood at some point, just from my parents liking them and my gran liking them. And yeah, it's very British to me. It's as British as a Yorkshire tea biscuit. And yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think it doesn't look like it's going to be overly taxing. And I think January is a nice time to watch something that's a bit of a laugh. It's not 3 hours, is it?
No, it's a lovely run.
Great.
Yeah, an hour and 45. About an hour and 40,
actually. If it's under 2 hours, that's even more of a sell. I'll get to it. I will definitely get to it, especially now that the performances have been nominated. I do want to make sure that I've seen as many Oscar and BAFTA, all those nominations before the actual big night.
Yeah. It's funny. Quite a few critics have said, "Oh, Steve Coogan's just doing an impression of." I was like, "Well, I guess he sort of is. Like, why is that a criticism? Like, he needs to be like the real guy. Otherwise, you're not going to think he's like the real guy. Like, if you're playing a real, where does a good performance and an impression of a historical figure? Like, what's the difference? Like, I think he's really good in the film, and I don't quite understand the criticism. Like, he lives the role. He's really great in it. He has lots of, like, mannerisms that you might associate with the real historical figure, but it's not like he just has 5 minutes in a comedy bodysuit or something and walks off. Like, he's actually really good.
I'll be interested to see if he can pull it off for me, because I am a little snippy on comedians stepping into, I know it's a British film, but like a Hollywood role, and pulling it off that in a way that isn't caricatured or just seems like a bit of a meme, you know.
I think the thing that grounds it is, like, they both have, they're like, they have like extreme highs in the film and they have extreme lows, and you see them at their worst when they're arguing, and, you know, when it looks like the tour might not be able to go ahead and that sort of stuff. And they can do that sort of, like, you know, very human, real people acting as well. Like, they're great actors, both of them.
There's clearly just a lot of love in this film from, like, because Baird's a very well-known Stan and Ollie fan. And then everyone around on the set, I think at the Q&A, he was at work, they all said that they all had to love Laurel and Hardy for this to come together. And that really shows there's a lot of respect for this comedy, you know, heroes. And then it all comes through in, like, every frame, every, you know, line, every sentence, every joke. It just comes through that everyone really wants to bring these characters, these real life people, to life, but also in a way that honors them but introduces them to a whole new generation.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on. I thought it was a really warm viewing experience. I watched it next to Sarah. We were both close to tears at the end.
The ending surprise. Like, I was.
They're just such good friends.
it's just so nice. They just love each other. They just want to be friends and
do
comedy together.
It does sound like an ultimate retro bromance movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it a Rags to Riches really movie? What other tropes can I pull out?
Rags to Riches.
Well, I look forward to hearing what you think of the movie. How many times have you seen it, and how many times are you going to watch it, Sarah?
Okay, I've seen it 3 times.
Whoa!
I might see a couple more times, because my dad is really, really, like, he just really wants to watch it. So I'll take him along. And then, yeah, I think I might watch it a few times. I'm a big John S. Baird fan. I'll champion his movies.
The video you did?
Oh, the video, yeah.
You blew me away. Like, that was made me want to see it more than any side of a bus.
So listeners, if you want to head to Pitch House Central Facebook page, we have our own double act, Courtney and Cook, which I am
so
a part
good.
Of. And it's a fun little tribute to Stan and Ollie.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Excellent
nice
production skills.
Thank you.
Great supporting act.
I directed and edited it myself.
Brilliant.
Well, it got retweeted by director John S. Baird. So, you know, you could be cast in the next movie.
That'd be my day.
The sequel.
And every year is off to a good start.
Oh, yeah. And I've also got the interview with him podcast.
Absolutely.
As
check
well.
Out the pod feed, listeners. We've got it's not even an interview with John S. Baird. It's more. We've got Shirley and Nina on as well. So it's a big Stan and Ollie special podcast, which is on this feed. Do check that out. All right, let's do one more film. So next week, you know, obviously big in the Oscar corridor right now. Next week, we've got a big performance one, I think. Beautiful Boy, starring Timothée Chalamet and Steve Carell, who I'm a bit in love with Steve Carell. He is so good. I'm rewatching The Office right now. That guy's a genius. This film does not look anything like The Office. But Sarah, you interviewed the director of LFF. Can you tell us a bit about what the film's about?
So the film is based on the memoirs of Nick and David Sheff, who are father and son, who unfortunately Nick suffered from addiction from a very young age. And it's all about their struggles. And it's told from, I think, 2 different perspectives, more on David's perspective of losing his son to addiction and how he struggled and how he was determined to bring his son back. But also you see it from Nick's side and how very intimate and intricate exploration of why he turned to drugs. And it's really, really powerful. It is. You said performance-led. Their performances are just outstanding.
That's performance with a capital P and then some, and an italic and a bold.
All caps.
Yeah. At his very young age, I just don't think it's fair that Timothée Chalamet is as talented as he is. And so good. So good at bringing, like, the depths and despair of the character, but also having these, like, eyes full of hope. And every time he tries tries to get better and falls back, and there's this realism to it, and they've got this really powerful scene. It's quite enough in the trailer of him trying to explain to his dad that this is him, and you know, this is all this despair and anguish is still part of who he is. And then obviously Steve Carell shines when he's doing dramatic roles.
I don't know. I think Timothy I was fully on board with. I totally was wooed by all the vulnerability and then the hope and the ambition to get better and then the cycle of, and the heartbreaking cycle of, you know, recovery and then relapse. But I think this is Timothy's film over Steve's personally.
I love how we're on first name terms with these guys.
Yeah,
well, yeah. Tim and Steve.
Yeah, I thought it was an emotional roller coaster in every term, and I think that's exactly what they had intended. But I think it's interesting what you said about how you think it explained the addiction. I felt that was lacking in somewhat. I don't know why this very privileged dude decided to get on crystal meth. Maybe I missed something, but he seemed to have quite a decent life, and he, not to say that that doesn't mean that he's going down a rabbit hole of destruction, but I don't know if that backstory, if there was one, was really articulated.
I think my struggles with the film is how poorly edited it is. In a sense that you can't quite grasp where you are in the time.
Yes.
And it struggles with that. But I think his whole point is that drugs just made him feel good and made him feel, he just didn't have that kind of loneliness in him, and drugs just filled that gap.
There was a couple of times I think they tried to explain why he, the depths of his dark soul by showing the doodles in his notebook. And it was a little bit like, oh, that's so obvious. What, somebody who doesn't really know what addiction is like, not that he doesn't, because he obviously does, but it seemed a bit on the nose. That's not to say that the performances don't pull any doubts that I had about it back, because I thoroughly enjoyed it, and yes, I had a little cry, but it was very public service message of don't do drugs ever. And I now won't.
On the posters, I think they're working with some sort of drugs awareness charity, and I see every time I see the poster of Beautiful Boy, I'm also reminded not to do drugs. I haven't even seen the film. but I really love Steve Carell, as I mentioned, and I'm not sold on Timothy, right?
Really?
What's with Timothy? I think he's fine.
He's a beautiful boy.
I swear to God, I've just heard like a million angry Chalamet fans, because he's got this fan. He's like a star, isn't he? A Hollywood star.
He dresses real nice on red carpets. Not going to deny him that.
He's got such a huge following. You can barely tweet his name without getting like loads of retweets. And his Q&A that we've got coming up at Pitch House Central sold out in like a day. Yeah. It was just...
I've seen you've got your Facebook and it's got thousands of people interested and lurking for spare tickets. But I can sort of see why. I don't know. I guess he was in a really popular movie, Call Me By Your Name. I thought the film was just fine. But he's got really like great supporting roles in things like Lady Bird. Like, I see he's good. I'm wondering what was it, Call Me By Your Name, that made him like AAA list?
I think in this culture, this generation, I'm not going to call them by the M name, but this kind of generation of cinema watchers really respond more to queer characters and gay characters. You've got to look at the sheer following that Rachel Weisz is getting for doing Disobedience and The Favourite. Mm. And I think this, even if they're straight in behind closeted doors, not that saying closeted doors mean I meant anything, I think that this kind of new wave of LGBT characters are just getting this loads of people who are just loving the representation and therefore will champion it and will push it and will include them in what has been termed stan culture and go crazy for it. And Timothy has done this really, really great stirring LGBT drama, and it has, and he's a very attractive young man.
Yeah.
I think his cheekbones mainly.
It's the cheekbones.
He's very moldable as well. He's got that vacancy that can be filled with whatever a great director wants to put inside him. Mm. And I think he portrays that very well. I think personally, I loved him in Lady Bird because because he didn't actually do anything, but he was the ultimate representation of what so many girls my age, any age, remembers dicking around with unnecessarily, and like, why are you wasting your time with this time waster? He doesn't like or love you or anything. And he was just a great articulation cinematically of that.
It's funny, his choice of films, like I think he's got the fan base of someone who's maybe been in like a Marvel blockbuster or an Avengers or something, but he hasn't done those. He's done very indie, very worthwhile, very like quite classy festival favourite films, but he's got this huge fan base. I think if he were ever to be in an Avengers, the fan base would get so big, no one would be able to accommodate.
I think Marvel would implode.
Yeah.
He's accessible because he's not this big, brooding, old school cut out of what a masculine man looks like. He's, and like you say, he appeals to so many different audiences, and everyone can fancy him because and feel he's an accessible person. You can confidently believe that you saw him in a bar, you might get his number.
Yeah. he's very confident in who he is and his how he presents himself on red carpets. He's very enjoyable. If you watch his Oscar run last year, because he was nominated for Best Actor, he's just got so much joy that I think has been missing for like a while from like the kind of cynical Hollywood. You've got this young man who's just really enjoying what he's doing, getting a lot of response to that, and then breaking the mold of masculinity. Like, he wore a vest, like a glittery vest, long sleeved outfit for the Golden Globes, and it's just that kind of smash of I'm here, I'm gonna have fun, and I'm super talented. And I could grate cheese from my cheekbones.
And this is where the casting of Timothy actually has really worked for this film, because we've just spent about 20 minutes talking about him and not the movie, which I think is the point.
He got us again.
I think you're right.
His enjoyment of this job is infectious. Like, he looks like he's enjoying it so much, it's infectious when you see him smiling and having fun. And that is nice, and that's refreshing. Mm. But I don't know. I guess for me, I'm waiting for the Timothy bug to get me. I'm sure it's coming. I haven't seen Beautiful Boy yet. Could be the one that pushes me over
the
edge.
Oh my God,
you're going to cry your eyes out, Sam.
I do. I love crying in films, listeners.
I've sort of
been putting this one off a little bit because I'm like, I don't have enough tears in me yet.
I didn't cry as much as I thought I would. It's a great father-son movie. It's a road movie in a way of like, the journey that they go through. I was a little bit disappointed with how underwritten some of the female characters were, considering they obviously had such a big part of his life, in that his mother was very vacant, the new wife was very much in the backdrop, and he had a girlfriend at some point, and she was just very disposable. Fair, it's about him and his dad, but I just feel like if you're going to put those three prominent female characters in there, they could have added a bit more grit.
I think we should call it a day there. That's a lot to think about, lots of movies out there right now. What are you looking forward to seeing at the cinema next, Sarah?
Oh, God, that's a good question. Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Oh,
Can You Ever Forgive Me? It's Melissa McCarthy, who's my fat girl actor hero, playing a queer writer who drinks whiskey with Richard E. Grant. It's just right up my street.
Nice.
We'll talk about that more on a future pod, but I saw it at London Film Festival. Loved it.
And we have an interview with Richard E. Grant and Melissa McCarthy by yours truly, so stay tuned.
Oh my God.
I can't believe, it's so nice when you get to talk to people in films and stuff,
great.
But Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant are in such legendary status.
They were so beautiful together. They're just
so jealous you got to do that.
It's very good.
How about you, Karina? What's your next cinema trip?
So I'm thinking that I should probably go and watch Mary Poppins and Stan and Ollie, but I'm also thinking about The Front Runner, which I've heard nothing but decent reviews for.
It's got The Greatest Showman in. Bit of Hugh.
But you
haven't seen The Greatest Showman yet.
I have not.
So that's the double bill you're going to do. You get The Greatest Showman on DVD and then you go to the cinema for The Front Runner.
The ship has sailed.
The ship will come back.
It will come back, and that's what I'm worried about. But for now, I'm going to make it my mission to make sure that I've seen all the films that I think are going to be nominated for all the Oscars, because we are well in this corridor now.
It's good, good to play the game.
I'm going to be in the know.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both, Sarah and Karina, for talking today. Thank you, listeners, for listening to this podcast. And a big thank you to Silk Factory, the lovely padded room we're in right now. I have to say, listeners, we're in a new room. It's got a lovely carpet. Very much enjoying that. But Silk Factory are proud supporters of the Picture House podcast, and we really love working with them. Silk Factory, if you don't know, are an awesome film marketing creative agency making the coolest trailers and creative content out there across TV, digital, social platforms. Every time they tweet something, I really want to like watch that show, they do so many like really great videos on their Twitter feed. Highly recommend following them on Twitter, basically. We think they're great. Go and check them out. Check out their fantastic work on their Twitter channel and on their website, thesilkfactory.co. Please do rate and share this podcast with your friends. Love seeing those reviews. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with some more Oscar goss. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.